Glenn Chambers sat in the departure lounge at Miami Airport. He was going out to serve the Lord in Ecuador. He'd been preparing for that day for many, many years. It was the 15th of February, 1947. Before the final call came to board his flight, Glenn suddenly felt an urge within himself to write a little note to his mother. Someone had left a newspaper lying around, so he tore out a page which didn't have too much writing on it. It just had an advert for something or other. He hastily scrawled out a little message, and he posted it. He boarded the plane and left the States behind. The flight was a DC-4 bound for Quito in Ecuador. It flew over the sea for a while, flew over a bit of Colombia, and eventually flew into the side of a mountain and exploded. Everybody on the flight, Glenn included, died. The families were told, how can you describe that sort of grief? A couple of days later, that note which Glenn had written from the airport arrived through his mother's door. She knew the handwriting on the envelope. She opened it up, her heart throbbing away inside her. But when she took that piece of paper out of the envelope, it wasn't so much the words which her son had written which grabbed her attention. It was the advert he'd written on. Because printed right in the center of the page, with Glenn's writing all the way around it, was just one word. The word, why? 5 times in Job chapter 3, you find the word, why? Job is suffering. Why? He asks. Now, Job was a conspicuously good man. If you know the story of Job, you remember that God says this about him in chapter 1, verse 8. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." So God's verdict on this man is that he is blameless, upright, God-fearing, evil-shunning. Job is a conspicuously good man. God points Job out to Satan. But Satan, Job, says Satan, is only interested in serving God for what he can get out of the deal. Job chapter 1, verses 9 to 11. "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." No wonder Job loves the Lord, seeing that the Lord is blessing him so much, says Satan. "But take away that blessing, and he'll soon curse the Lord." That's what Satan thinks. So God stakes his reputation upon Job. Chapter 1, verse 12. The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then. Everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. So the Lord allows Satan to afflict Job to prove that he, the Lord, is good enough to be loved for his own sake, and not just for what he gives. He allows Satan to afflict Job to prove that a man can hold on to God even when apparently there are no benefits attached to doing that. So throughout much of the rest of Job chapters 1 and 2, Satan pounds Job with one disaster after another. He loses all of his wealth. Then he loses all of his children, all 10 of them. Then he loses his health and he's reduced to sitting on an ash heap, scraping, seeping pus from his angry skin with a piece of broken pottery. Job is shattered, but he doesn't curse the Lord. Instead, he speaks out in faith. Job chapter 1, verse 21. Job said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." And in Job chapter 2, verse 10, Job says, "Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" He keeps on trusting the Lord and keeps on maintaining that the Lord has acted justly and rightly. Now, at the end of Job 2, we're coming up to date, three of his mates arrive, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And they see what Job has been reduced to, and they are stunned. This is what we read in Job 2, 12 to 13. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights. No one said a word to him, because they saw how great his suffering was. They weep aloud, they tear their clothes, they sprinkle dust on their heads. That is exactly what people did when someone died. They're treating Job as if he was already dead. There is a time, isn't there, just to go and sit with a friend in all of her grief and to hold her hand and to say nothing. But Job's friend seems somehow bankrupt and devoid of comfort. Mourners at a graveside, except the deceased hasn't quite died yet. So, there is Job, the paragon of virtue, sitting on an ash heap. His past is lost, his future is empty, his present is pain. His skin is festering, his nerves are on fire, his friend's body language has condemned him to death, and a week passes. And by the end of that week, things have got to Job. He starts to believe the body language of his friends. He starts wondering what on earth is going on here. This is real. This is the real experience of many, many of God's people in furnace conditions. They find themselves wonderfully upheld by the Lord at the moment of crisis, and it's afterwards, as time passes, that questions surface. Dark questions, terrifying questions, accusing questions, and such questions launch us into Job chapter 3. So look at verses 1 to 3. We're going to whip over the chapter very quickly, then we're going to pull back and we're going to look at three lessons. Verses 1 to 3. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. He said, "May the day of my birth perish the night it was said, a boy is born." Can you hear him? "I wish I'd never been born," he says. "I wish I'd never been born." Now, notice what Job does and does not do. He does curse the day of his birth. He does not curse God. He does pour out the violence of his grief-stricken heart. He does not blame God. So still, even now, he is proving Satan wrong. Even though the lofty words of chapters 1 and 2 may have slipped into the background, still Job is keeping his integrity. But he has lost the will to live. He dare not look forward, because the future is misery, and all he can do is look back in desperation, wishing he could change the past, wishing actually he could erase the past and so make himself non-existent. And there are times when true believers in the Lord, people just like you and just like me, experience that. The future is anguish, and all you can wish for is that you did not exist, and that in fact you had never existed. I wonder if you know what I mean as I say that. Have there been times in your life where you just wished you'd never been born? That is precisely what Job feels. And he keeps on expressing that in verses 4 to 10. Just look at verses 8 to 10. "May those who curse days curse that day, those who are ready to rouse Leviathan. May its morning stars become dark. May it wait for daylight in vain and not see the first rays of dawn, for it did not shut the doors of the womb on me to hide trouble from my eyes." Over and over, "I wish I hadn't been born. I wish my birthday had never existed. I wish I'd never come out of my mother's womb." And that is misery. As we reach verses 11 to 19, the next section really in the chapter, Job moves from cursing the day of his birth to asking questions. And in particular, he asks the question, why? Why, why, why? You get it in verse 11, verse 12, verse 16. You get it later in verse 20, verse 23 as well. So look at verses 11 and 12. "Why did I not perish at birth and die as I came from the womb? Why were there knees to receive me and breasts that I might be nursed? Why didn't I die at birth? Why didn't I die the moment I came from the womb? Why did I live long enough for my mother and father to dandle me on their knees? Why did I ever survive to suck milk from my mother's breasts? Why didn't I die? And there's worse in verse 16. These are words which would be incredibly offensive were it not for the fact that Job is suffering so bitterly. Or why was I not hidden in the ground like a stillborn child, like an infant who never saw the light of day? Why was I not stillborn? Why did I ever see the light of day? Why did I have to live? Why didn't I die? Job then wishes he was dead. He sees the grave as a place of peace, verses 13 to 15. For now I would be lying down in peace. I would be asleep, at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who built for themselves places now lying in ruins, with rulers who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. For Job, the grave is peace, sleep, rest. Death is the end of his present despair. Of course, it's only later in the progressive revelation of the word of God that the truth about heaven and hell is gradually revealed. Job wishes he'd not been born. He wishes for the quiet restfulness of the grave. And that is misery. And now we're coming to verses 20 to 26, the last chunk in the chapter. Job is still asking questions. He's still asking why, but now he's asking in a more general way. Look at verses 20 to 23. Why is light given to those in misery and life to the bitter of soul, to those who long for death that does not come, who search for it more than for hidden treasure, who are filled with gladness and rejoice when they reach the grave? Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? Why is life like that? He asks. There are some people who just want their lives to end. They're in misery. Their souls are filled with bitterness. They long for death. They search for death. They rejoice when they finally die. And yet in the meantime, they still have to live and see the light of day. Why is life like that? Why can't people who just want to die, die? Why can't I just die? And then verses 24 to 26, Job ends his speech with a moan. The sighing comes to me instead of food. My groans pour out like water. What I feared has come to me. What I dreaded has happened to me. I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest, but only turmoil. Racking groans come from Job's whole body. And the last verse in the Hebrew produces a terrible staccato effect. Literally, it says, no peace, no quietness, no rest, turmoil comes. And that is misery. There's Job 3. Job starts with a curse in verses 1 to 10. He longs for death in verses 11 to 19. He ends with a moan in verses 20 to 26. Misery. We're going to slow down now. And we're going to look in greater depth at three lessons which Job 3 illustrates for us. Actually, we're going to ask and answer three questions about misery. Question one, how does faith affect our misery? How does faith affect our misery? Or let me phrase that question a bit more provocatively. In chapters 1 and 2, it looks as though Job's faith has completely triumphed over his troubles, doesn't it? And Job said, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I will depart. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away, may the name of the Lord be praised. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Doesn't it look as though Job's faith has just raised him above the despair which he might naturally have felt and made him immune to feeling any kind of sorrow? And we might be tempted to draw a lesson that goes a bit like this. There's Job. He suffered. He trusted. Be like him. The end. We might be tempted to say that faith triumphs over misery in that way. And there are so many hymns, old and new, which suggest things just like that. And in his presence, our problems disappear. Our hearts responding to his love. Not a doubt, nor a fear, not a sigh, nor a tear can abide while we trust and obey. Faith triumphs over misery, we might say. And then we come to Job chapter 3. And it's like one of those beauty treatments where immediately after having a sauna, you're suddenly hosed down with icy cold water. All of a sudden, it's, why is light given to those in misery and life to the bitter of soul? So what has happened here? Has Job lost his faith? Has he lost the victory of a triumphant life? Just how does faith affect our misery? Is the Job of chapter 3 a paler, weaker version of the man we met in chapters 1 and 2? How does faith affect our misery? Well, here's where we can start to come towards an answer. Job mentions God in verse 4 and in verse 23. We're just going to look at verse 23. Listen as I reread it. Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? Now, do you hear what Job is saying in those words? In Job chapter 1, verse 10, Satan accuses God of putting a protective hedge around Job. But here, Job says basically the opposite. He says that God has hedged him in. It's as though he's put razor wire all around him, an electric fence to stop him escaping. He feels hemmed in and trapped by God. So, if you think about his words, it means this. Job does not doubt God's existence. He does not doubt that God is in control of everything. What puzzles him is this. He finds himself utterly bewildered about what God's purposes might be. So what we have here, actually, are the struggles of a believer. Job knows that God is there. He knows that God is in control. After all, it's God who has hedged him in. It's just that Job cannot understand what God is doing. In later chapters, we'll find him wrestling with God and wanting answers from God and speaking boldly to God. But all the while, his struggles are the struggles of a man whose heart is going out to God. They're the struggles of a believer. Job really is trying to hold faith and experience together. He knows that God is there. He knows that God is in control. It's just that he does not understand how a good God could find any reason behind his present sufferings. Do you see then what Job's faith is doing? It's clinging on. It's clinging on. And it's clinging on even though it doesn't understand what God is doing. Yes, there are doubts. Yes, there are questions. Yes, there is bewilderment, but his faith is clinging on. He knows God is there. He knows God is in control. It's just God's purposes which are beyond him. Now, what does that mean to you and me? Well, it illustrates a great lesson about faith. Faith will not necessarily give you a complete sense of peace and serenity at all times, an immunity to sorrow, though God does give us that peace which is beyond comprehension, doesn't he? If your body is racked with pain, you will feel lousy. If you love someone, if you lose someone you love, you will grieve. If you are reduced to such poverty that you cannot provide for your family, that will weigh very heavily upon you. But for the Christian, at such times, your faith will cling on, even when it doesn't fully understand. Many of you will know the story of the hymn writer William Cowper. When he was six, his mother died, and he was absolutely devastated, as you can imagine. He wrote a poem years later describing how he saw the hearse moving away from the house. He was sent to boarding school, where he was bullied mercilessly. When he left school, he got engaged to a young lady, and then her father withdrew permission to marry her. Then he descended into some kind of psychotic illness. He tried to kill himself three times. He was admitted to a psychiatric hospital, which would have been pretty bad back then. It was while he was there, actually, that he became a Christian. The thing is, becoming a Christian did not stop him getting depressed again. There were four more excruciating periods of depression which he faced. And many of the hymns which William Cowper wrote reflect the darkness which he felt all around him. Lines like, where is the blessedness I knew when first I knew the Lord? Still, though, his faith was clinging on, and he continued to walk with the Lord. William Cowper died in 1800. Not long before he died, he wrote, "I feel unutterable despair." And yet, as he died, this strange sense of peace and calmness descended on him. Do you see what was happening? His faith was clinging on. He knew God was there. He knew God was in control. He couldn't understand everything. His mind was confused, but his faith was clinging on. Faith then will not necessarily give you a complete sense of peace and serenity at all times, an immunity to sorrow, but it will cling on, even when it doesn't fully understand what's happening. And that is why it's so important that you keep your faith fresh and lively in those times when you are not suffering. That's why it's so important that you exercise faith in your normal, everyday life. The more your faith is put to work in those times, the better it will be in the hard times. So how is your faith? When, actually, did you last do something which required faith for you to do it? When did you last do something scary? When did you last do something which might have failed? When did you last stretch your faith? If it hasn't been a while, well then, get out there and do something. Exercise your faith. You need it all the time. But you especially need it when those hard times come. And they will. Perhaps, actually, you have no faith at all. Perhaps you've never asked God to forgive you for your wrongdoing. Perhaps you haven't put your trust in Jesus Christ who died and rose to save people. Maybe you've never started to live for him. Well, if that's true of you, please come to him. You need faith. More than that, you need the God in whom you must have faith. The question is, how does faith affect our misery? Well, sometimes God gives us Job chapters 1 and 2 faith. Faith which enables us to sail through our troubles. And sometimes he gives us Job chapter 3 faith. Faith which enables us just to cling on. That is what Job illustrates for us. And that is how faith relates to misery. Second question, and I'm going to speed up now. Is it okay to pour out your misery? Is it okay to pour out your misery? You see, there are some who would condemn Job in the strongest terms for what he says in Job chapter 3. How dare he wish he'd never been born? How dare he wish he was dead? How dare he say such strong things? As we read the passage earlier, maybe you were wincing. Or let me put it another way. A Christian friend of yours has a stroke, and you go to visit him. And after a few minutes, he says this to you. Why did I not perish at birth and die as I came from the womb? Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, who God has hedged in? No peace, no quietness, no rest. Turmoil comes. What would you say to him? And more importantly, what would you think? Is it okay for him to say such things? Is it okay for Job to say these things? Did he sin? Well, the answers are these. Yes, it was okay for Job to say these things, and no, he did not sin by saying them. Let me show you that. I don't know if you're one of those people who always read the last page of a novel first so that you know how the story is going to end up. We're going to have to do a bit of that now. Job chapter 42, verse 7 says this, right at the end of the book. Job 42, 7. After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, "I am angry with you and your two friends because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has." Now, the Lord is not saying there that every word Job has spoken is right, but he is saying that the general thrust of Job's words, especially those words he's spoken about him, about the Lord, has been right. Job has been along the right lines in what he's said. That means that Job is justified in speaking the way he does. And I find that hugely encouraging. It means that God does not blame us if we vent our feelings, if we cry, if we unload our emotional pain, if we confess our loss of hope, if we share our sense of futility, if we ask for questions, answers to those tough questions. In fact, we can go further than that, can't we? Job's example means that God does not blame us. If we vent our feelings towards him, if we cry to him, if we unload our emotional pain upon him, if we confess our loss of hope to him, if we share our sense of futility with him, if we ask him to give us the answers to those tough questions, God does not blame us if we pour out our sorrows in his direction. Actually, he loves us to do that. He loves it when his children come to him as father and pour their hearts out to him. He loves it when his children come to him as father and cast their cares upon him. He loves it when his children prove their dependence upon him by doing that. It is okay to tell him the passion of your breaking heart. In fact, if you look elsewhere in the Word of God, you find other people expressing exactly the same sorts of feelings which Job expresses here. Jeremiah chapter 20 is way stronger than Job chapter 3. Psalm 88 is even stronger than Jeremiah chapter 20. There must always be a sense of reverence in the way we speak to God. But he's big enough to take our outpourings of misery. Self-control, after all, is not stoicism. Self-control is not putting a check on our feelings, or at least the display of our feelings. It's managing them in a godly way. So it is absolutely fine to be open with the Lord. It is better to be candid in your despair, frank about your grief, honest with your questions, than to put up some kind of front of puffy piety. If you bottle up your feelings, they will find some way of getting out and of biting you in the end. And anyway, God knows all about your feelings. He knows all about your thoughts. It is okay to pour out your misery. And of course, there's an even better example of this than Job, isn't there? Do you remember a man in a place called Gethsemane? Do you remember how troubled he was there? Do you remember how he said that his soul was overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death? Do you remember his prayers asking God to deliver him from the terrible prospect of the cross the very next day, but always submitting reverently his prayers to God's will? Do you remember Jesus pouring out the sorrow of his troubled heart to his heavenly Father? If not, read Matthew chapter 26, verses 36 to 46 later, and see that it's okay to pour out your misery. Job did not curse God. He spoke words which God regarded as right enough. But he did pour out his misery. How do you feel at the moment? Is your heart breaking? Are you overwhelmed by some agonizing situation in your life? Are you bleeding inside? Well, then tell the Lord about it. Pour out your misery towards him. Don't curse him. But do be open with him. It is okay to pour out your misery. And question three, even more briefly, where is God in our misery? Where is God in our misery? Now, C.S. Lewis is famous for writing all of those Narnia books. He also wrote a number of other books defending Christianity and a book called A Grief Observed, which some of you will have read, I'm sure. He wrote it very soon after his wife died. Initially, it was published under a false name, but once C.S. Lewis himself died, the publishers revealed that he had written it. It's a very honest book, so listen to something he writes, looking back to the death of his wife. He wrote, "Meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing him, so happy that you are tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption, you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. Do you hear what he's saying in his misery there? He's saying, look for God when you really, really need him. And where is he? Non-existent. And that is, even for true Christians, how it feels sometimes. A door slammed in your face and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. Where is God in our misery? Where is God when it hurts? Now, as we've seen, Job himself does not doubt God's existence or God's power, control. It's his purposes which puzzle him. But as the book of Job goes on, and obviously we don't have time to read the rest of it, there's this mounting sense of frustration within the man. He keeps on crying out. He keeps on asking for answers. He keeps on pleading with the Lord for help. And what does God answer? For chapter after chapter, nothing. A door slammed in his face and the sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. And that is sometimes how it seems to us. The suffering goes on, the sorrow increases, the misery grows, and there seems to be nothing from heaven, nothing at all. At times like that, what are you to do? Well, you can do something which Job could not do. In the end, Job did meet with God, and it gave him perspective in his suffering. But you, Christian, you can do something else. You can remember a man on a cross. There are people everywhere, but he is alone. And if you'd been there, you would have heard the most extraordinary words ever spoken. My God, why? My God, why have you forsaken me? And why are they the most extraordinary words ever spoken? Because God the Father had turned his back upon God the Son made man. It couldn't happen to the God who is love, but it did. Jesus was more alone than anyone ever. And as he spoke to God, what was the answer at that point? Nothing. A door slammed in his face and the sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside, if I can say that reverently. Job, of course, does not know about this. But we live on this side of Calvary. And it's Calvary above everything else which shows us where God is in our misery. Calvary proves that God is still there, that God is still in control, and that he loves us more than we can possibly know. He loves us that much. And it's that, in the end, which gives us hope in our misery. And that's why I want us to sing There Is a Hope now as we come towards the end. It's a hymn which just points us to the great hope we have. It's very honest and open about our sufferings, isn't it? It acknowledges that those hard times come. But for God's people, we do have a hope. And we have a hope simply because of Jesus Christ. So when the music starts, let's stand and we'll sing together.